This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane and famous Exxon gasolines. The wake-up call is also brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. Now with your host, Rick Moore.
Oh, boys and girls, my gosh, it's the first Sunday in July. It's the first day of July. We're halfway through the year of 2007, and I am exhausted, and I don't think it has much to do with the time on the calendar. I think my weekend has been rather exciting. Great dogs, great people, apparently great alcohol with great food, nonetheless. Bear with us today as I try not to. You can't see me yawn on the air. We do have a wonderful program lined up for you, but due to mechanical difficulties, mostly within the body, we're going to test some microphones and see if we have to make a quick change. Oh, let's do ladies first. Shannon Rook from Whitehall Vineyard. Shannon, how are you? Yeah, see, there we go. We're going to have to fire that up and switch over to the middle microphone. So, Graham, let's do that and get everybody switched over to the middle mic. I would like to take a moment and thank the folks at Bang for tolerating me this weekend. and our folks here in the studio. We're going to talk about Virginia wine industry. I think it was described in the early notes as past, present, and future. That's because we're going to talk a little bit about the history, a little bit about the current events of the Virginia wine industry and the growth, the future. We are represented today with Shannon Rook from Whitehall Vineyards, Chad Zacabe from Jefferson Vineyards. Let's see if we get some voices now.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, Rick. How are you?
There we go. That's what we need to hear. The lovely voices, Shannon Rook, Chad Zacabe. Whitehall Vineyards, correct?
Yes.
Got to talk into the microphone. Don't be looking at me. Break that personal aura. Chad is a nice guy. He's got a blue blazer on.
That's right.
He smelled good. I got close enough to get a whiff when he was coming in. He was waiting outside for me. He promised not to hurt you.
We'll have to sit cheek to cheek.
Cheek to cheek. See, if only people could get the photo, you know, if we had the little camera up in the corner of the studio, they'd just be so happy to see how, you know, how nice and friendly the wake up call can be.
That's right.
All right. But we are, we promise to have the serious moment here throughout the hour, although I don't promise that that'll be a heavy percentage today. We are going to have a fun time. And yes, you're only going to hear out of one ear on your headphones. That's because they're on a splitter. So one of you should have the left ear and one of you should have the right ear. But I'm not forcing you to share headphones so that you can each hear.
That's next week.
That's next week's show. Yeah.
That's a whole different show.
That's what the fundraiser is all about, is fixing things so that that works properly. Let's see. You know, let's start with some of the basic stuff. How many Virginia wineries are there now? Because I was reading something, and in 1979, there were only six, but now there's something over
127.
Over
127 wineries and over 200 independent vineyards in the state of Virginia, which makes it the fifth largest wine-producing state in the country.
That's incredible that over 25 years that there's been that much growth.
Yeah, it's something a lot of people don't know, is the growth of the industry over the last 25, 30 years.
And why is that? Why has there been so much growth? Has the wine industry in general across the nation experienced that much growth? Or has there been an emphasis in Virginia to have it grow that much?
I think the initial source of the growth in Virginia was the Farm Wineries Act, which allowed Virginia wineries to circumvent the three-tier system in order to grow their businesses. And so we were allowed to make wine, sell wine directly to wine shops without a distributor, and then also sell wine in our little tasting rooms at our wineries. And that is what really enabled the growth. But subsequent to that, I think a lot of people have found some very compelling places to grow grapes in Virginia. And so while the national industry has grown dramatically, I think Virginia has really skyrocketed beyond the national average simply because of all of those elements.
I think one of the things that a lot of people forget, at least to continue on this historical aspect, is that wasn't our man, Thomas Jefferson, wasn't he the original wine expert in the early stages of America?
Jefferson planted vines in Albemarle County in 1774, but he really didn't have much of a shot of making a decent bottle of wine.
Why is that?
Well, as we've learned this past week, it's so humid in Virginia, you get a great environment for mold and mildew and bugs and pests, and those things attack vineyards. And so without the capacity to spray insecticides, herbicides, fungicides, things of that nature, Jefferson would have had a very difficult time. Now, the other thing is, frankly, Jefferson was a great dabbler in things. So in 1774, they planted vines. In 1776, they all got very busy trying to build a nation and basically let the whole thing go.
Yeah, that sounds like me. You know, I start a project, I get partway through it, and then it's like, can somebody else finish this, please? My interests have moved on to other things.
That's about how it worked out for them, too.
Number of cases that are currently put together in Virginia versus, you know, in some sort of comparative fashion?
Right. Well, it ranges over the course of the last few years. You've seen wineries come out that are on the smaller range. I would say about 85-90% of the wineries in Virginia make about 3,000 cases or less. Then you have that middle tier, which Jefferson and Whitehall Vineyards tend to be part of, which make between 6 to 10,000 cases. And then you have the upper tier, which are probably Williamsburg and Prince Michel that make upwards of 70,000 cases. So that gives you a range of how many wineries and what kind of production they're doing.
How do they make so many?
Bigger tanks, bigger machines.
They have the ability to
do they have the acreage?
Purchase the equipment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, wine is perfectly scalable. You have to do exactly the same thing, all the same processes to make 100 gallons of wine that you do to make 1,000 gallons. So if you want to make 1,000 gallons, you've just got to have more grapes. You've got to have a bigger tank or more barrels or, you know, whatever, more yeast, whatever it is. But you can still have one person doing it. And that's one of the things that's interesting about the wine business in general, is that there are only 30,000 families involved in the wine industry in the United States. And it's because one group of people can make an incredibly large volume of wine because they just buy bigger machines, they get bigger tanks, they have bigger barrels, you know, they just scale up their operation.
If you can afford the process of making that that bulk wine, then it tends to be feasible for you to do it because there's always going to be a market for it.
Now I realize that the two of you are representing, Shannon, I think you called it sort of the middle tier. In terms of size. Does the quality of the wine change as you go up or come down?
That's a tough question. The reality is there are good wines in everybody's portfolio. In all 127 wineries, there's a gem in every single portfolio. Now, as you grow your business, you probably have greater resources to bring to it, and you can buy a better pump or a better press or a better filter or you know, a better barrel. And barrels are very, very expensive. So as you grow and you start to see greater cash flow and hopefully greater profits, you can continue to invest. And so it's not necessarily the case that size determines the quality of the wine, but it's oftentimes the case that you have a very serious business plan put together in that middle tier and in those upper tiers because there's much more at stake. as opposed to somebody who's making wine in their basement and selling it to their friends, and they're making 500 cases of wine a year. It might be unbelievably good, but the investment that's required is probably somewhat smaller.
Can you make wine in your basement? I mean, I just have visions of my friend Dave, who likes to home brew some beer,
right?
And then every once in a while, he'll walk into his home brewing space and find that, you know, the yeast and the carbonation have blown the top on everything, and he has quite the mess to clean up. Does it work that way for wine? Can you literally, you know, buy, whether you're growing the grapes in your, you know, arbor in your backyard, sure, or whether you're going somewhere and buying a bunch of grapes, can I go to Whole Foods or someplace and buy, hey, you know, I want 40 pounds of grapes. You know, can you do that?
Well, there are certain types of grapes that and varietals that you have to use to produce
The seedless red grapes aren't going to cut it?
Those would be delicious, but probably not for making wine.
But anybody, anybody
although
can make wine.
I would be interested to come back in a while after you've given it a shot.
It's a great idea.
Yeah. We would help you drink it.
Definitely.
Well, I'm going to take a few days off. By the way, just for those who are interested.
But we do have people that come to the winery and ask to use our smaller production. When we were actually just starting in the early 90s, we had, you know, to hand bottle everything and hand put labels on and hand harvest everything. We still do a lot of that today. However, we have machinery that will take care of some of the larger tasks for us.
Do you? Both of you? I mean, at Whitehall, by the way, it is Shannon Rook from Whitehall Vineyards, Chad Zacabe, Jefferson Vineyards, as we talk about the Virginia wine industry. Do you allow that? You know, say I've got all my juice. Can I show up at your place or rent the time and space during certain times of year, I guess when you're not using it full stream, to take advantage of that?
Yeah, a lot of wineries do. Mm-hmm. A lot of wineries make a bit of money allowing people to come in and use their facility. The law is a little bit restrictive because if it's made at Jefferson Vineyards, even if it's made entirely by you and with your grapes and your barrel and your yeast and your time and your money, if it's made under my license at Jefferson Vineyards, then in the state of Virginia, I have to own it. And then subsequent to that, either sell it in my tasting room or sell it to a distributor. And that makes it a little bit difficult because unless you're a distributor or you sort of have some way around that, you're going to end up making the wine and then I have to either buy it from you and sell it back. You get in this very convoluted environment, and it's a reflection of outdated ABC laws. It's really what it amounts to.
And we're going to get into that in a minute. I guess current legislation and ABC law is coming up for us to talk about. Each of you talked about the middle tier, but to over 3,000 to what, 10,000 cases?
Yeah.
And again, I ask to compare that to some of the places in California, I guess.
Right. I was recently at a marketing seminar in San Francisco and got to sit next to a few of the larger wineries, and I don't know how large they do get. Maybe you can probably speak a little on that. But the people that were sitting next to me had a team of marketing experts and very experienced staff, and they actually were making upwards of about 2 million cases a year. So just to give you a range, there are some very, very large wineries out there, especially in that state.
Yeah, it's important to recognize that in the hierarchy of wineries in the United States, they're sort of tiered by production volume by the government and whatever else. And so as you go down in the tiers, you go from a large winery, which is, you know, upwards of 1.5 million cases, to a medium sized winery, which is, you know, 500,000 cases, to a small winery, which is 100,000 cases of wine, to a boutique winery. So a boutique winery, small artisan producer, something similar to what we have in Virginia. But the federal government defines a boutique winery in the United States as anyone who produces 25,000 cases of wine or less. So in Virginia, you know, we're a hash mark on that scale, and the reality just becomes, you know, that's a reflection of agribusiness on the East Coast. That's a reflection of hurricane season. it's a reflection of a challenging environment to grow grapes, but subsequent to that, it's a reflection of the way that these businesses have been built, which is to say, we don't have big distribution operations. Most of us are selling the majority of our wine at the winery or over the internet. And so it's a direct-to-consumer business. And that's, frankly, pretty attractive.
Oh, I'm curious, because you always read about this or hear about it, is, oh, that was a good year for that wine. Mm-hmm. You know what? That wasn't, you know, I don't know if the word bad is used, but.
Well, it is right now, actually.
Yeah, sure.
So I'm curious as to what makes a good year versus a bad year for wine.
It could range anywhere from the type of the percentage of moisture that you have in the soil, all the way to the humidity in the atmosphere, all the way to. For example, this year, actually, with the early freeze, the late freeze that we had, and the hailstorms that came in the weeks following that.
It snowed and like Easter Sunday. It hasn't even been 3 months since we had our last snow.
I've been speaking to a lot of the smaller wineries in the last few weeks, and everyone is kind of going through the same problem. We've actually lost, I would say, 30 to 40% of our largest production, which is our Chardonnay grapes for 2007 vintage. Right. So I think a lot of the 2007 vintage wines are going to, I think they'll probably, what we do get will come out as a positive and very crisp wine. However, our production is just not going to be as high for 2007. And I think it's probably going to be the same for everybody else in the area.
Yeah. And you have a tremendous number of variables, which can be everything from a late spring frost like we've gotten in this instance, which wipes out part of your crop. In Charlottesville, we were sort of on the edge of the most severe damage, so a lot of us had a varying degree of damage. Down south side, below Lynchburg and Roanoke and down to Danville in that area, you know, a lot of those guys had more greenery exposed because it's warmer typically, and so their growing season starts a little bit earlier. So they had more greenery exposed, which all got burned off. And they've reported catastrophic losses, quote unquote catastrophic losses, to the state agencies. So that's where you sort of start, and then you go all the way through the year. If it rains, you know, remember in 2003 it started raining in the spring and it basically didn't stop until we had a hurricane in the fall. That was a bad year. If you want a textbook bad year, that was it. So, I mean, you have all of these variables, late frosts, bad weather during harvest, bad weather in the run-up to harvest, all that kind of thing.
So are we saying that good year versus bad year is related to number of cases produced versus and not taste?
Absolutely not. I think that you would probably go more towards the
quality of the
wine. Yeah, quality of the wine. Definitely.
The reality is, one of your variables is the yield. So if you have a very abundant year, if you have a very strong flowering and then fruit set and growth and good weather through the year, you can have a big production of very high quality wine. What you don't want is a big production of very low quality wine. And so as we go through the year, we make changes, but wineries make changes in their vineyards by, for example, what's called green harvest. So when we have a big abundant year and less than ideal weather, we'll go through and cut fruit off the vine to change the ratio of greenery, which stays about 100%, to fruit. If you cut that in half, we've got all of the greenery pumping its energy into half the fruit, and that's how you get riper fruit. So those are the kinds of adjustments we make along the way. But the way to judge, frankly, the way to judge the strength of vintage is really to wait it out. And the whole business is about patience. But you wait it out, you taste the wines. The 06 wines, you recall we had Hurricane Ernesto September 1 of last year. And the 06 wines have turned out beautifully. So while it wasn't a non-event, it didn't have the kind of negative impact that it could have had.
Well, it also depends on exactly when in the harvest cycle you get the moisture. Because when you have a late hurricane, if the grapes have already and the clusters have already formed, then the moisture will just kind of add to the growth of that cluster. However, if you have a rain that is very large and earlier on in the season, when the clusters are forming, it will actually form around that moisture, and you'll get a lot of mildew and other problems within the cluster. So those clusters are pretty much worthless after that. There's a lot that goes into it.
It's a brutal
business. Really, it's an interesting business to be in because, I mean, we probably both have friends that are in sales outside of the wine business, and they have something that they have that they can sell, you know, without a problem.
Yeah, you're making windshield wipers.
Exactly. Those are never going
to
go out.
You wait for a big order to come in, you ramp up your production, you buy all the stuff you need, you make your windshield wipers. In the wine industry, you get one shot a year.
And you kind of have to go with what Mother Nature gets you.
Yeah, I mean, it's humbling.
All right, 11:21 here on the wake-up call. As I'm getting a great education, I hope you are too. But if you have a question or a comment, 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. That's the toll-free number, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS, 979-0919. Chad Zacabe, Jefferson Vineyards, Shannon Rook, Whitehall Vineyards. Let me give you the information on today's weather, since we were talking about that. Mostly sunny today, highs 80 to 85, mostly clear tonight, lows 50 to 55. Sunny tomorrow, highs 75 to 80. Right now it's clear in the valley at 73, and in Lynchburg we're at 72. Mostly cloudy in Richmond at 77, but then clear here in Charlottesville and 73.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by The Hook and by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, a refreshing pause on your journey to anywhere with locations all over town. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And let's thank Blue Ridge Mountain Sports for their support today. Blue Ridge Mountain Sports featuring outdoor footwear, including sandals from Teva, Reef, and Keen. Also at Blue Ridge, it's performance shorts and tops from Patagonia and the North Face, making your summer outdoor adventures safe, fun, and enjoyable. It's Blue Ridge Mountain Sports. They're in the Barracks Road Shopping Center here in Charlottesville, the Mountain Inn at Wintergreen in Richmond, and at brms.com. You know, if you're listening on the new Harrisonburg 95.1, you can dial us up. Graham's out there to patch you through on the toll-free number. If you're closer, take advantage. All right, back to our topic today, the Virginia wine industry. Fire that microphone back up, the shared microphone. Thank you for being so nice and close today. I do want to talk about the recent laws over the last few years in Virginia, the legislation regarding wine, wine distribution, et cetera. And correct me if I'm wrong on this. Very brief notes. 2003, Governor Warner signed something into effect that said that wineries could distribute out of state. All right. And there were obviously some issues involved with that. You had to be over 21 to sign for it, et cetera, et cetera. But you could distribute out of state, which was something that was expected to help the wineries grow at a tremendous rate. 2006, there was a law that the wineries could not sell directly because it was considered unfair to out-of-state wineries. And then this year in 2007, a law put in about, I guess, sort of taking some of that back, where if you were really, really small and you were under 3,000 cases, that you could, again, or you could, anybody could sell their first 3,000 cases directly. Mm-hmm. Right. Well, now that I've tossed all that out, I am going to take a phone call from Doug in Richmond. Hey, Doug.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing well, man. You got a question or a comment for our guests?
Yeah, I was getting ready to make another batch of plum wine.
Nice.
I did this back in 2002, and we just finished it off, just small deal, 5-gallon bucket. And the tree is loaded this year, and I was wondering about leaving the seeds in. I don't remember if I left the seeds in last time or not, but it turned out really good. I got the recipe on top of the bucket. But Should you get the seeds out? Will that hurt anything by leaving them in or make it bitter?
I think you ought to pull the seeds out.
Filter it?
Yeah. We go through this thing called a process called delestage, which is to say you basically strip out, you pull out all the seeds.
Why does that sound really fancy?
It's French.
Or use a cheesecloth or something.
Yeah.
I mean, that's...
Or a colander from your kitchen.
I took 2 1/4 gallons of plums, 6 pounds of sugar, 1/2 pack of yeast, forked a lemon, waited 4 weeks and strained it. Then I added another cup of sugar and put it in the refrigerator, let it cool to stop fermentation.
Doug, did you bottle this or did you keep it in the 5-gallon bucket?
We left it in a 5-gallon bucket and just finished it off last month or so. But it was a good tasting wine. It wasn't real sweet, wasn't real dry. And like I said, the plum tree is loaded this year. I was wondering how much you can make legally at your house too.
For your own use, you can make much, but just about as much as you want.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't be selling it to your friends.
Yeah, once you start putting a label on it and trying to sell it, then that's where you run into some problems. But
Don't hold me to that, but I'm pretty sure they won't mess with you too much if you're just making wine out on the farm or whatever it is.
That's truly boutique.
That's right.
I would say so, yeah.
That's not on the national scale.
All right. Thanks, Doug.
All right. Thank you. Y'all have a nice day.
You too.
Yeah, take the seeds out.
And
watch how much sugar you're putting in that now.
Yeah, definitely. Seeds tend to add a little bit of bitterness, so you probably don't want to do that because you won't have enough sugar to counteract that whole taste.
Graham is out there to pass through the phone calls. So back to the legislation issue. I'm curious, why did they put in the first law about being able to sell out of state and then a few years later sort of restrict that?
It's actually two different markets that were addressing. The first one was about direct shipping, which is to say a winery shipping wine to you as a consumer, which is circumventing a wholesaler, which those guys don't particularly care for because they want a piece of that money. So the first law was about Virginia wineries being able to ship wine out to Virginians and people in other states where it is allowed by that state. In 2006... we were confronted with the fallout of a Supreme Court case wherein the Supreme Court said that the repeal of prohibition and the enactment of laws in all 50 states to control alcohol does not trump the Commerce Clause of the Constitution, which means every state has to treat their in-state wineries is exactly the same as they do their out-of-state wineries. So if an in-state winery could sell wine to a wine shop directly, then an out-of-state winery had to be allowed to do the same thing. And what the Supreme Court was trying to do was open up the marketplace. And for the most part, that worked. But in a lot of states, including Virginia, the wholesalers and distributors lobby, which is very powerful and entrenched and well-funded, was able to sort of dumb down the system and bar any winery in Virginia or outside of Virginia from selling to a wine shop in the Commonwealth. And so what they did was they locked up the 3-tier system, meaning Shannon and I and all other 127 wineries had to go through a distributor to get our wine to a wine shop. Now, we could still sell directly to you, but we had to go to a distributor. That's obviously a problem. I mean, that really put the hurt on our small wineries. And the larger guys in Whitehall and Jefferson and, you know, some of your bigger wineries or that middle tier and up, we all have distributors. We work with those guys. They're our partners, and they make money on our wine, so it worked out.
Well, and I would disagree with that a little bit, and I want to toss that in there in a few moments. As someone who runs a store that sells wine in a retail manner, and how we were affected by that. But I want to go back and talk about a little bit more about the legislation itself first. Do you, and again, we are here with Shannon Rook from Whitehall Vineyards and Chad Zacabe, Jefferson Vineyards. What were the negative and positive fashions of how the law affected you? I mean, did it give you more businesses to sell to? Did it give you a steadier method in which to sell? Did it help or hurt your profit margin? Did it allow you to spend less time focusing on the selling and more time on the marketing? You know, touch on some of those things.
There were definitely positive and negative aspects to the changeover that happened last year. Like Chad was saying, as a larger production, we were already working with the distributor at that time to appeal to the markets that we had in outside areas, such as Roanoke and even anywhere over from Waynesboro up to D.C. and Richmond and those areas, and Virginia Beach as well. However, in a local market, it's always been much more positive to be able to approach the customers on a personal basis and be able to talk to them on a daily basis and fulfill their needs directly as opposed to going through a third party. So that personal interaction was definitely lost. Financially, we definitely took a huge hit the first year. However, to have that base that the distributors do have in the marketplace kind of counteracts that. We are selling more wine, we're producing more wine. So there is a direct correlation between the bill passing and us doing poorly and well as.
Yeah, I mean, it's a complicated thing. The reality is it does allow us to spend, by not going into the market here in Charlottesville and selling wine to wine shops and restaurants and that kind of thing, it allows us to spend more time working on the business itself because we're not calling up and talking to people and trying to figure out who needs an order of a case or two cases and spending a day driving it into town. The bad news is now we're not talking to people. We're not driving wine into town. We're not standing around in a wine shop chatting and talking about what's going on and building that kind of a relationship. So in that way, a lot of these businesses, and including Jefferson Vineyards, have suffered because we've been separated from the largest of our markets, which is outside of Charlottesville, and now we're separated from our core market, which is Charlottesville. So that was tough. At the same time, it does allow us to bring that time and energy to working on the business itself, to work on the tasting room operation, to work on to work on a new website or to work on a newsletter, to work on any number of things that can help us sell more wine.
Have you sold more wine?
Our production is definitely up, and we're trying to meet the local standards, yes, definitely. And we're also taking our sales into different states along mm-hmm. the region. So it's definitely, I would say, yes, our sales are definitely up.
Yeah.
However, in the tasting room, it's definitely, like, that's where the majority of our profits come from, is the tasting room sales. Mm-hmm. So as Chad was saying, it's vital for us to get into the tasting room and to focus our efforts more on bringing people to the winery as opposed to coming and talking to the local marketplace. However, one of my favorite things about my job before the law was enacted was getting out there and coming to see, you know, you and coming to see all the people that we love talking to. And then
sure.
2 days a week getting out there and actually carrying the cases myself to the different places. It was a lot of fun to be able to get out and talk to people that way. Now I'm more so refocusing my efforts to try and get people out to the winery, which is where we're making most of our profits nowadays.
I think it's important to recognize also, just in the general timing of things, with the 400th anniversary of Jamestown and huge numbers of extra tourists in Virginia, that definitely has an impact. And we've seen significant growth in our sales in 07 through wholesale and at our retail facility. And it's not as a result of this law. It's really, maybe that's part of it, but it's really the greater attention that we've brought to Virginia wines through our PR campaign and our work during the legislative session. The greater number of tourists and attention that's being focused on Virginia right now with the Queen coming and all the rest of the Jamestown celebration. And those things probably in combination have a bigger impact than the law itself.
It's also extremely important to talk about the smaller wineries because, like we touched on before, 85 to 90% of wineries make 3,000 cases or less, and this law really, really, they suffered completely over the course of last year. A lot of them were trying to focus more of their efforts on getting people to the tasting room, however, didn't have their tasting room fully set up yet. So as wineries that were financially established by the time this law was enacted, it was easier for us to make that transition because we were already working with distributors. The smaller wineries definitely were the ones to talk about when it comes to the suffering after the law.
So the mom and pop places, because it seems like, we mentioned about the federal law is 25,000 cases or less to be considered a boutique winery,
right?
And how almost all of the Virginian wines fall into that category. It just seems like that if you look at that from a Virginia standpoint, that the mom-and-pop wineries suffered a lot, and for those who were large enough to say, okay, I can stop being a mom-and-pop winery and work with the new rule, just with the refocus, are the ones that, I don't want to say saved themselves, but certainly altered the vision a little bit.
You could take a hit and continue on. But if you're in that very fragile state where you're just starting out, you've made 1,000 cases of wine and you're trying to take it into the city of Lynchburg from out in Bedford County, you're one of the tiny little wineries on the Bedford County Wine Trail, you just lost your major source of revenue. And that's just, that's unfortunate. We did have a few wineries that closed up shop. We did have quite a few people who dramatically changed what they were doing, and we recorded that and took it to the legislature this year and said, this is the pain that this legislation that you enacted is causing. This is what you're doing to agriculture in Virginia. And it's important to recognize Virginia is an agrarian state. It's always been an agrarian state. And it's not a program crop state. It's not corn and soybeans and wheat and cotton. You know, those are not things that we have in Virginia. You go out west and you're growing corn, those guys get $5.7 billion in federal subsidies. The wine industry in the United States gets just about nothing. So for someone in our position or a larger winery, you can take the hit and you can work around it and you can find a way to continue on and grow a little bit and make it work for you. If you're a tiny little producer, and somebody just cuts you off from your market, and you don't have people coming out to the winery, you're done for. You know that's just it. So that was what was difficult. And this year, in the legislature, we were able to get a law passed basically that would allow those small wineries and any winery to sell 3,000 cases of wine, up to 3,000 cases of wine, through a Department of Agriculture run wholesaler. Now they will take a transaction fee for bouncing paperwork around and that kind of thing, but it allows Virginia wineries and wineries outside of the state to get back to the market. It's an extra step. The margin isn't quite as good, but frankly it's more state government, but it's going to allow those folks to continue.
All right, I want to come back to that in just a moment. 11:40 here in the wake-up call as we talk with Chad Zacabe, Shannon Rook about the Virginia wine industry, touching now on some of the recent legislation that's gone through over the last year or two. Feel free to dial up, ask a question, make your comment, 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by the Markins of Tiger Fuel and by The Hook, an innovative weekly on newsstands every Thursday. Now here's Rick with what you can find in this week's Hook.
Oh, what is Camp Wahoo? Why was it so novel when it started? Why did it take a 40-year hiatus? And why is it back now? The Hook takes a look. After repeated controversy with flyers being sent home through student backpacks, Albemarle County bans the process. And were you aware of the new laws that could cost you several hundred or even thousands of dollars for otherwise minor traffic offenses? Is financial ruin now on the law books? The Hook, history, future, and current events all in one easy-to-carry paper. And let's thank Five Guys Burgers and Fries for being here for us today. Five Guys serves America's standard fresh and handmade from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. and open until 10 Fridays and Saturdays. That's Five Guys Burgers and Fries behind the fountain in the Barracks Road Shopping Center, in the Hollymead Town Center, and now on the downtown mall, all in Charlottesville. On the web, it's fiveguys.com. That's F-I-V-E-guys.com. And Blue Ridge Graphics has always been there for us. Blue Ridge Graphics at the corner of Meade Avenue and East High Street in Charlottesville, providing custom T-shirts and sportswear, plus promotional items for schools, organizations, and businesses. That's Blue Ridge Graphics, 296-9746, and at brgtshirts.com. All right, we got a call coming in from Kelly in Stanton. Hey, Kelly.
Hi. I was wanted to talk about the Virginia Alcoholic Beverage Commission, and I was surprised to find out that they are actually able still to buy directly from vineyards, whereas retailers cannot. They have to go through a distributor. It just seems to me unfair that they can bypass the law that was passed last year.
Ooh, good point. I'm going to hang up and let the guests answer to that, okay?
Thank you.
All right, who's jumping onto that?
Yeah, the ABC, the Virginia ABC agents have all the power of a local sheriff. They can walk in your business and shut you down. They carry guns, and they're very powerful guys. But they're also the ones, not the agents themselves, but the Virginia ABC, they're the ones who wrote the laws. And so the reality is what they of ABC law in Virginia is that the state is a market participant. And as a market participant, the state runs ABC stores, so they're selling all the liquor. And they brought Virginia wine in an effort to help the industry grow, and it certainly has. But as a market participant, they're a very powerful, very, very powerful player. And so they give themselves maybe privileges that are not fair, but you don't necessarily want to mess with them.
Yeah, and I see both of you being a little cautious because you also don't want to make them mad, do you?
Well, they're good guys. I mean, the agents that we work with are good guys. They help us. They try to make sure that we're aware of changes in the law and what we're supposed to be doing. And their primary goal is always to make sure everybody's in compliance, not to come and shut you down or, you know, unless you're doing something reprehensible.
And I've found, you know, those of you who listen regularly know that I run the Forest Lakes Market, and obviously we sell alcohol, and I've always found that their goal is to be helpful.
Yeah.
And they are nice and polite because they have jobs to do, and they don't want to be jerks about it. They aren't, it's not like you, they took their, or went into that career or that profession because they are the biggest jerk in town. They're not. Mm. They're very friendly. They're very helpful.
And they're very fair.
Yeah, and they're just doing their job. I mean, it's hard to, it's one of those you can't shoot the messenger ideas. They're just, right. They literally have a career to do. And
but that's
it's
the person.
It's a hard career.
As an individual, and I think what Kelly is calling about is the organization
the
and the group.
Right.
Choosing to do something that sort of sets them aside a little bit and says, you deserve different rules that everyone else doesn't have to play by. And I think that that's a fair question to them. And,
sure.
And they need to stand for that and ask and answer why. And obviously the three of us are not going to be able to do that today here in the hour, but it's a good question, Kelly. And I wish we did have someone here who could answer to that.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately we don't. But I wasn't aware of that. I'm sure that the two of you were, Shannon and Chad, Whitehall Vineyards, Jefferson Vineyards. Anybody else with a good question? 979-0919-1877-WNRN-ROCKS. Graham will, patch you through. Back to the legislature, issue and the changes that went through it. One of the things that I've discovered by having to deal with this now where Shannon can't bring me the case or two that I ordered and can't bring it to me directly and having to go through the distributor is my sales of Virginia wines are down because it's such an effort to get them. Because instead of Shannon looking at me as somebody who is near the airport, is on, and this was obviously before the amount of fluid you could carry, but was near the airport and was on a major travel road in and out of town, and was part of a set of stores that, I guess, not to be snotty about it, but has a little sort of high quality atmosphere in the area, and I could call up and she would bring me a case in the next couple days. But now I'm just one of those places that somebody, that some salesperson has to go visit. And my distribution, I don't see the distributor or as often. And it just seems to be so much of a hassle to do it, to get it. And I'm curious as to whether the sales are down locally in general. You talked about expansion into other market areas, but how have things happened in the Charlottesville-Albemarle area?
Well, I think that there are positive and negatives, both of them. You being able to call up, here's a great example. We have the Piedmont store, which is about half a mile away from Whitehall Vineyards, and they order a bunch of mixed cases, or they used to before the law was enacted, and I could actually literally put it in the back of my car and take it to them within a half an hour. And that kind of person-to-person connection was definitely important. However, from the retailer perspective, you also get a great combination of all the different wines that the distributor can bring to you. So you have a longer list of wines that are available to you, and not just you don't have to make that phone call to me. You can just make that phone call and order a lot of your wines at the same time. It's kind of us working with the distributor and their sales reps to make sure all the needs are met and to still make that personal connection. It's a difficult thing to do, though, and we're all kind of adjusting to it.
Yeah. I mean, it can be cumbersome.
Chad, have you found that that the sales dollars or percentage have grown outside of the Charlottesville-Albemarle area, while down a little bit within where you used to be able to do it on a more local manner?
Yeah, that's a good question. What it amounts to is we've definitely seen greater demand from Richmond and Northern Virginia and outside of the Charlottesville area. But certainly, there are the accounts that we've always been in. I mean, what I've seen is that the accounts we've always been in are still moving through wine because they were dealing with our distributor in the beginning. But I'm not seeing a lot of new accounts. And that's one of the ways that we really grew our businesses in the past, simply by going to the new restaurant or going to the new wine shop. And walking in and saying, hey, have you tasted these? We're 4 miles down the road. We can bring this to you, et cetera, and give you a competitive price. So we really haven't seen that. And I think that's a function of that distributor's representative out there with thousands and thousands and thousands of options. And not always keeping Virginia wines right at the top of their list, despite being in sort of the heart of the Virginia wine country.
Wouldn't that be because the distributor doesn't have to focus on your wine? Or do they get any pressure is not the right word I want, but do they have any desire or need to push Jefferson or Whitehall wines when instead the boss, whoever's running the warehouse says we need to move this, put it on some sort of allowance or discount, something similar. It's the Australian wines that we're putting on special for July and August. And the salesperson has no personal or company desire to particularly push Jefferson or Whitehall.
Well, really what it comes down to is getting that personal desire to support a local market. I mean, and it's not just from the sales reps or the distributor. We also need help from the local retailers, the local restaurants. You have to make that place for a local industry on your wine list. You have to be able to have that as an option for people that are coming in from out of town or people that live here locally. It's something that you need to take pride in, and so it really comes from every person in the business.
Sure. But it's also just that, and I agree with you completely. And the reality is, if we want to see an incentive for those salespeople, then we have to pay for it. And that's just it. I mean, what we've just gone through is a big hit to our margin on wine that we end up, that ends up being sold through your shop or through local wine shops. So we've already taken a big hit, and now if we really want to be competitive and throw money on the table for a distributor's representative to pick up as a result of selling our wine, it continues to come out of our pocket, so we take an even bigger hit. And these are small businesses. I mean, you know, when you make 1 million, 2 million cases of Yellowtail Shiraz, it doesn't cost you that much per bottle, and you've got a bigger margin on it, and you can throw money at it in that way. When you make 800 cases of Chardonnay Reserve or 500 cases of Cabernet Franc or Viognier or something of that nature, you know, every bottle counts. So that's where, given the size, we're at a bit of a competitive disadvantage.
You know, Chad, you that last point made me think of something that I wanted to get to earlier when we were talking about good year versus bad year. Can one wine that has a good year while another wine have a bad year within the same year?
Sure.
Definitely. Yeah, the varietals change so much just within themselves that you can actually have a grape that grows really well here in the state, but over the mountain, or here in central Virginia, but actually, you know, 30 miles west of here, it doesn't do so well. And the vintage obviously will change that as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you can have, you know, again, for 2006, we had a hurricane on September 1. Most of our Pinot Gris, and probably most of your Pinot Gris or Pinot Grigio, the grape, I was in the winery, and it was the product of a beautiful growing season. If you recall, the summer of 06 was great. Well, then we were gearing up for the Chardonnay harvest, and here comes 13 inches of rain, and it rained for 10 days afterwards. So while the vintage as a whole was very, very good, and the Pinot Gris harvest was fantastic, the Chardonnay harvest was a big challenge. And those wines have turned out beautifully, but it was a big challenge. So, you get those differences, again, just based on weather and, you know, weather over time as well, not just a specific weather event. Right,
what harvest. A lot of people don't realize is how long harvest will stretch on for. I mean, it's an eight to 10 week, 12 week process that
really?
Our guys are out there working, you know, I mean, yeah. 14, 16-hour days for 8 weeks and, you know, 10 weeks in a row. And the weather can change so much because, like Chad said, you're bringing in different varietals at different times.
Mm-hmm. All right, 11:54 here. Time for a question or two. If somebody wants to dial up, 979-0919-1877, WNRN Rocks. Shannon Rook, Whitehall Vineyards. Chad Zacabe from Jefferson Vineyards, both local, as we talk about the Virginia wine industry. I do want to thank 45fix.com for their support today. If you have a project but not the time, there's a simple way to find a contractor. From kitchen and bathroom remodeling, house painting to decks and siding, that's 45fix.com. Immediate no obligation estimates available anytime. That's the number 4, the number 5, and the word fix.com. And as though you would, I know you won't go anywhere today for Les Temps Purdue following us. Best of 80s and 90s alternative, no Cinderella, no Milli Vanilli, really, no Debbie Gibson, but you will hear Red Hot Chili Peppers, Duran Duran, Blondie, and I'm sure by my request, and R.E.M. Dial up with your request. Les Temps Purdue, brought to you in part by Plan 9 Music, only on WNRN. And this is WNRN Charlottesville and WNRS-FM, Sweetbriar, Amherst, Lynchburg, as well as the new Lovingston 94.7. All right, back to our guest today. Just a few minutes left. I'm curious, Shannon, Chad, we talked, I believe, Chad, you mentioned something about the federal subsidies for corn in other states. What does the state as a whole do to support the wine industry? I mean, because you didn't get,
sure.
You didn't get the, you know, go from 9 or whatever, 6 wineries in 79 to over 120 something in 25 years without some sort of help.
Well, the state has always provided us, I think the number is about $500,000 in marketing funding to run the Virginia Wine Marketing Office, et cetera. That funding hasn't really changed in any significant way over the past few years. The upshot of that is that Some of the biggest competition that the Virginia wine industry will see in the near term is from neighboring states. And when you look at the investment that North Carolina, for example, is making in their wine industry on the order of a little over $1 million a year for a nascent industry, for an industry that's literally just getting out of the gate, it becomes a little scary, because what we're seeing is an increasingly aggressive state funding outside of Virginia, and a more lackluster effort within the state. That really falls on us to educate legislators and educate our state leaders about what we need and why we need it and how we need them to support us. And we're in the process of doing that now, and we'll no doubt see some change. But they've always supported us. It's always been a good relationship, and we've always turned a tidy profit for the state in terms of tax revenue. So it's a good deal.
Shannon, I'm curious, how does one wine vineyard separate themselves from everybody else?
Well, that's something that I really love about this industry. I've been in this business for about 2 years, and Chad's been here maybe 5 or 6 years now. When I came into it, one of the best things about it was kind of the camaraderie between all the different wineries. I could call Chad up. All of us are on a first name basis. I can call him up with a question, or, hey, what are you guys doing this year? It's kind of, we all work together because
you have something that
exactly,
I need.
Yeah.
I need 3 bottle boxes. You know,
exactly. Yeah, exactly. It's something that we all, the reciprocity between everybody is really, it's something to, yeah, definitely. It's all kind of a big family, which is great. And we all work together to promote the industry as a whole, which is a lot of fun.
All right, we got a call here. It's perfect timing, and my guess is that this person is somehow involved in the wine industry, but it doesn't say that because it's a great let's finish up the show question. Jane from Charlottesville wants to know, a source of information for Virginia wines as a whole and wine events.
I think certainly for the entire state.
Their Virginia website?
Yeah, virginiawines.org.
Definitely.
Do you spell that out, or is it VA?
Virginia spelled out, wines, plural, .org is a website that we're working on now and is up. But the other resource is the Monticello Wine Trail, which is our regional group of 5 counties right here around Monticello and right around Charlottesville, and that's MonticelloWineTrail.com. And there you have, on both sites, listings of events and contact information and maps and routes, trails that you can follow, ancillary, B&Bs and restaurants and all of that kind of thing that really form the community of Virginia wine and food.
And, if you know how to Google Virginia wines, we'll bring up all kinds of interesting things.
Definitely.
Shannon and Chad, thank you so much for coming on today. I appreciate any hour someone spends with me, rainy or snowy, but especially when it's nice and sunny on a beautiful summer day. I appreciate you coming in very much.
Thank you.
All right. So check out the sites to get more about Virginia wines. Shannon Rook, Whitehall Vineyards, Chad Zacabe, Jefferson Vineyards. Next Sunday, one of the more interesting Sundays I think this show might ever experience, as we go into a show that I'm currently calling eavesdropping, where we have 4 women who work together, who come in, and I can finally find out what women talk about when they're all sitting together and giggling. All right. Bye, boys and girls.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday, and by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane, Exxon gasoline, and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at abstractme@aol.com or at wnrn.org. The wake-up call is produced by Michael Strickland. Tune in again next Sunday morning at 11 for the wake-up call, only on WNRN.